This is the Penobscot Bay Report and Gulf of Maine Monitor. On October 19, 2010, Dr. Habib Dagher, director of the University of Maine's Advanced Structures and Composite Center, spoke for an hour and 16 minutes at the first annual Maine Deepwater Offshore Wind Conference. Dr. Dagher talks about how the Deep Sea Wind Consortium's plan for developing over-the-horizon floating wind farms is progressing.
Today, why we're looking at offshore wind in the state of Maine, a bit of some upcoming goals for us as a Deep Sea Wind Consortium. The Deep Sea Wind Consortium was established through the Department of Energy. We received funding from DOE to look at the competitive needs, and there's 35 companies involved in the consortium, and that's growing right now. And we have some key deadlines, and these are the deadlines I'd like to show you. In 2011, which is April, we're going to build 50 scale models of different kinds of floating wind turbines. In 2012, we'll deploy a one-third scale unit. To put that in perspective, a full-scale unit of floating wind turbines is about 300. The blades will be about 180 to 200 feet long per blade. So these are big structures. So a third scale unit would be about 100 feet to the hub. These are very large structures, and this will be deployed for only a few months off Monhegan Island at a test site. That's in summer 2012. In 2013, our goal is to build a 3 to 5 megawatt single floating turbine. By 2016, the goal is to have a 25 megawatt stepping stone farm. It's a floating farm that would have a number of these 3 to 5 megawatt units. So if we have 5 megawatt units, we'll have 5 of those in the farm. If we have 3 megawatt units, we'll have 8 of those in the farm. And this would be a stepping stone farm. Essentially, it's a walk before you run approach. Once we build that by 2016, we would like to extend that by 2020 at that same site with a larger farm, a farm in the order of 500 to 1,000 megawatts. And then beyond 2020 is to build a bunch of these farms in the 500 to 1,000 megawatt range to reach 5 gigawatts or 5,000 megawatts by 2030 off the Gulf of Maine. And that's the plan that's been put together by the Deep Sea Wind Consortium, but also by the task force the governor's put together. The governor put together a task force to study ocean energy and put together a goal of 5 gigawatts by 2030 for offshore wind. And that's part of the task force goals. A bit about who we are. The Composite Center of the University of Maine was established in 1996. We have 140 full and part-time employees in the lab. And what do? We're a link between the composite industry in the country and the construction industry in the country. The construction industry is the second largest industry in the U.S., second only to healthcare, and knows how to use steel and concrete and timber, but doesn't know how to use advanced materials in construction. The composite industry includes the Owens Corning's of the world and the Ashland's of the world that understands fiberglass and resins and advanced materials, but really don't understand how to build bridges or wind turbines out of these materials. So the SLAB was established in 1996 by the National Science Foundation in Maine to bring these two industries together. And you might ask, why is this lab looking at offshore wind? If you're looking at putting floating structures, billions of dollars of equipment, 20 to 50 miles offshore, you want to use materials that have low corrosion, low maintenance, and that's why advanced materials and composites are being looked at, and that's why we're doing this work. The lab is being expanded as we speak. We received a grant from the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, as well as one from the Maine Technology Asset Fund, as well as the Maine voters voted in June 8th, and that allows us to build the first and largest offshore wind lab in the country right now. And that's in addition to our current laboratory, the Composites Lab, and that will open in May of 2011. The purpose of this lab is to be able to build and test components of these floating turbines in the lab before we get them out there and put them in the water. So that's happening as we speak. Chimbrough is the contractor building it. We're glad to have Pete Vigio here with us. He'll talk about his involvement. What happens inside the lab? Can we build large composite structures like this and take them out 20 or 30 miles or 40 miles offshore? This is an example of what can happen in Maine. This is a bridge being tested in our laboratory. It was tested last year. It's a 70-foot span that we put the equivalent of 75 years of traffic on in our lab in about a couple of months. This is a composite girder that's filled with concrete on site, and that weighs about one-tenth the weight of a steel girder. The DOT, Maine DOT, liked the design,
enough that they've decided to build the longest composite bridge in the world. That's happening here in Maine today. It's being constructed. It's about a 550-foot bridge in the Booth Bay area. It's called the Knickerbocker Bridge. So Maine is doing things that are not happening anywhere else in the world. We are building the largest composite bridges, and could we take technologies like this offshore to build floating wind turbines? Most of you don't know, but the Penobscot Narrows Bridge has carbon fiber strands. Some of the strands holding up the bridge are made with carbon fiber. Why carbon fiber? Because of corrosion resistance. We're studying here the effects of using these advanced materials to not only lighten the weight of these cables, but make it more corrosion resistant that will last longer. And the universities get these things hooked up to the sensor system, and we're monitoring the performance of these cables versus the steel cables. Other technologies have come out of the lab that can bring to bear to what we do offshore is a technology called the bridge in the backpack, developed in our lab, that's graduated from the lab now. It's a private business. The company is kitting bridges in Maine and selling them all the way across the world. This is a bridge that comes in a 60-foot span that comes in a bag no bigger than a humane hockey bag. You can inflate it on site, and it gets rigid within 3 to 4 hours, and then you fill it full of concrete. They're essentially hollow tubes you fill full of concrete on site. Think about using technologies like this way out there offshore to reduce the logistics of deployment and the cost of deployment. Maine also happens to have built the longest all-composite boat ever built by the U.S. Navy. This is a project we worked on with Hodgson Yachts, over 150-year-old company in Maine that spun off a new business called Hodgson Defense Composites, going after large, high-performance composite vessels. This boat is for the U.S. Navy SEALs. It goes over 50 knots, and the hull replaces an aluminum hull to reduce the wave impact forces. With an aluminum hull right now, when you're at 50 knots and have 4 or 5 foot waves, the wave slamming forces are causing shattered molars with the seals. They're breaking their molars. They're damaged bones. And the University of Maine got together with Hodgson Yachts and designed and built this shock-absorbing all-composite hull that's been delivered on time and on budget to the Navy. And now it's being tested across the country. That would reduce the G-forces by up to a factor of 5. So let's go down. This is a bit of the background. So Maine can do a lot of things that have not happened, or is doing things that haven't happened in other places across the country. Let's move on to the energy piece. One of the most sobering statistics I can tell you about today is roughly twice our state budget leaves the state of Maine every year in fossil fuel costs. Our largest single export in the state of Maine is our dollars. We send away $5 billion every year in fossil fuel costs. Now, if we were able to keep 20% of that, $1 billion a year, by generating our own renewable resources in Maine, the statistics show we can create anywhere between 7,000 to 15,000 jobs for every $1 billion that stay here in the state of Maine. So how do we generate energy in Maine and keep from sending some of these dollars off the state of Maine? This is some statistics about your families, Maine families, back in 1998, in 2008, in 2018. We picked 2008 because of the June 2008 cost of gasoline. Most of you remember the $4 a gallon that we were faced with back in June and July of 2008. All of us were in a tizzy. How do we stay warm as a state at $4 a gallon of gasoline and heating oil? We're the most heavily reliant state on heating oil in the country. So when gasoline prices go up, heating oil prices go up simultaneously, and the state of Maine sees the burden twice. Most other states who use natural gas and others don't see that same burden that we see when fossil fuel prices rise. Now, if you look at the family budget, every one of these charts is a family budget. I'd like to provide the Ocean Energy Institute here the credit for producing these. George Hart did those here a few years ago, and we verified them at the university. What you see in blue here are the energy costs for the Maine family. In yellow are healthcare costs for the Maine family. And in green is what's left to live on once you've paid your energy bills and your healthcare bills as a family. So it doesn't look very good if energy prices rapidly rise over the next few years. You might ask, well, where do the numbers really come from? Well, they're not really very difficult to get at. If you look at June 2008 and assume that those energy prices stayed on for a whole year, what would have happened for the Maine family? And by the way, electricity was not the problem for the Maine family in June 2008. We're all worried about how to heat the homes by buying enough heating oil to put in that heating oil tank in the basement, and how to put gasoline in the cars. And let's put some numbers to that. I remember myself back in June 2008, I usually fill up my car once a week, and I was putting in about $50, $60, or $70 a week to fill the car. Is that reasonable? How many of you remember those numbers? $50, $60, or $70 a week, okay? Let's say it's $50 a week to fill up the car. The average family in Maine has two cars. How many of you have two cars in your family? Just about everybody. Okay, so let's call it $50 a week per car times two cars is $100 a week. Times four is $400 a month. Times 12 is $4,800 a year. So it's $5,000 a year just to fill up the gasoline tank on the two cars. Okay. How about heating oil? The average family in Maine uses about 1,000 gallons of heating oil a year. At $4 a gallon, that's $4,000. So 5 plus 4, we're at $9,000. At that time, the electricity cost would have been about $1,000 over a year. So $10,000 would be the energy cost for your Maine family. The average Maine income in the state, family income in the state, is about $40,000. So 10 out of 40 would have gone to energy. So roughly a quarter of the family budget would have gone to energy. So what would happen if we go back to $4 a gallon? How many of you believe we're not going to go to $4 a gallon again over the next decade? I think we're all on the same page. So what do we do about that? What do we do when we go back to $4 a gallon or $5 a gallon? Last year, China became the largest user of energy in the world. The Chinese economy is growing at 10% this year. What will happen when China and India start using more of the oil that's out there, and the cost of energy is going to go up? How fast it's going to go up, nobody really knows, but it will go up sometime in the next decade. And we need to be ready, and that's really what we're looking at to do. So over the last few years, we looked at different ways that Maine can participate in this renewable energy revolution that's taking place across the world. And this chart, I had an opportunity to show the Secretary Hsu here about a little over a year and a half ago. It shows on the vertical axis in red the total electricity use in the United States. As a country, we use about 4,000 terawatt hours a year of electricity. That's the total United States use of electricity. Next to that red chart, red column, there's different forms of ocean energy for the whole United States within 50 nautical miles of the U.S. shores. So the different forms of ocean energy are deep water wind, that's defined for in waters depth of over 100 feet. And you can see here, deep water wind is almost as big as the total U.S. electricity production. The third column is shallow water winds in water depth of less than 100 feet. The fourth column is for the whole U.S. is wave energy. The fifth column is tidal and stream energy. And finally, ocean currents is the very last column. So if you look at the United States as a whole, the largest untapped renewable energy resource, ocean energy resource in the United States is deep water offshore wind. Now, why are we separating deep water wind from shallow water wind? The wind doesn't blow harder when you go to deeper waters, but what actually happens, you have to build the structures differently. The foundation systems change. This is a map of the U.S. showing where the wind blows and the wind doesn't blow. We all know, we can set it for said, this wind doesn't blow all the time. We're not trying to run the state of Maine on wind. We're trying to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by taking a bite out of the fossil fuel addiction that we have here in the state. If you look at the wind in the United States, white here means no wind, okay? And yellow is better than white, pink's better than yellow, purple is better than pink, and red and blues are the best. So where is the best winds in the continental United States? They're from North Dakota down to Texas. We call it the T-Boone Pickens Corridor, where T-Boone Pickens wanted to build wind farms and build transmission lines across country. But if you look at where the real wind is, it's really offshore. The best winds are offshore. 78% of the U.S. population lives in coastal states. And the best winds exist off the coastal states. Now, and if you look at the east coast of the U.S., when you go from Texas up to Maine, the wind gets to be better. You see the reds, you start with yellows and pinks here in, around Florida, and the wind gets to be better and better if you go up the east coast. So the best winds are offshore, and the better ones are north side of the east coast. So we happen to have a tremendous resource in Maine. And if you add up how much wind we have, it's called the potential for wind, within 50 nautical miles of our coasts, that's called the wind potential. Nobody wants to go out and build anything like that. We have about 149 gigawatts of wind. Now, to put that in perspective, a gigawatt is roughly one nuclear power plant. So 1 gigawatt, roughly one nuclear power plant. Maine Yankee used to be 0.8 gigawatts, 1/10 of a gigawatt. So when we have 149 gigawatts out there within 50 nautical miles of our shores, we've got to pay attention to it. That's a major resource. Now, can we get it cost-effectively back to Maine? It's going to take some hard work to figure out how to do that. Nobody says we're going to be able to beat the cost of coal or natural gas with offshore wind. What we're trying to do is give it our best shot. Can we get there? And we need to do the work to figure out if we can get there. Now, the other issue that you deal with that's important to us is where the population in the U.S. is. Every small black dot on this map is 7,500 people. So if you look down over here, for example, there's a lot of black dots together, and you can all recognize right here Atlanta, Georgia. And then you look at this map and you see where's a lot of black on this map. One of the largest population concentrations in the U.S. is in Northeast U.S., where you see a lot of black right here, near the shores. If you took the state of Texas, turned it into an oval form, and placed it across the Northeast United States, you capture 55 million people, 18% of the U.S. population, that currently pay the highest electricity costs in North America. And over the next 20 years, this population's concentration is going to need a lot of renewable energy. And so the business plan that we put together for the state of Maine is sell clean electrons to this population centers. And when you think, it doesn't look like it's very busy when we're up here in down east Maine here, but it's we do live in the busiest neighborhood in North America. So we have a major opportunity here to create jobs by sending clean electrons to these population centers. Now, are others looking at that? Of course they are. And it is no surprise that the majority of planned or proposed offshore wind projects are off the northeast coast of the United States for the same reason we just talked about. And you can see here all the different planned or proposed offshore wind farms. And the most well-known one is the Cape Wind Farm. That's about a 468 megawatt farm planned for Massachusetts and been in litigation for 8 years or so because a number of people who live near the coast don't want to look at the farm. And I'm not going to take a position on that, but we respect that. And in Maine, we decided not to go in that direction. We decided to go farther offshore, over 20 miles offshore, so that you don't have to look at these units because of the curvature of the earth. But in addition to that, the wind gets to be a lot better. I'll show that in just a short while. And the other thing that's different between Maine, what Maine is doing, what the rest of the world is doing is, the rest of the world, including Europe, since 1991, Europe built its first offshore wind farm in 1991. Europe has shallow waters near its shores, and they've built offshore wind farms in water depth of 100 feet or less, typically in Europe. In Maine, we don't have 100 feet waters or less unless we want to put these wind farms right a mile or 2 miles off the coast of Maine. That's not what we want to do. People come to Maine to see nothing. That's why we have a wonderful industry. We come over here, we look off the coast of Maine, and we like to keep it that way in any plan that we put together. So unless we put these things very close to shore, we're going to be looking at them. Okay? So we've made a decision at the outset, at least at the university with the Deep Sea Wind Consortium, to go far enough offshore so that the curvature of the earth makes these things disappear. But there are advantages to that, we found out, major advantages. One is the cost can be dropped versus fixed-based turbines. Now, most of the people who work in the offshore industry would think, you know what, the farther, the deeper the water is, the more expensive these things are going to be. Well, let's take a minute, maybe not. Our numbers that we've developed over the last year show that the answer to that question is maybe not. And why is that? We'll talk more about Europe in a minute. Fixed foundations are costly to erect because you need heavy equipment. There's high risk because the weather gets bad when you're assembling things out there. And there's major supply chain issues. If you go to floating turbines, you can make these things year-round in dry docks. Just like potentially you can make them in Bath Ironwork shop or in Chimbrow shop in Brewer, manufacture these things year-round and then throw them out there pretty much completely assembled if you could, and then erect them. If you did that, you're no longer at the mercy of the weather in building these things. And then the cost, as you all know, of building something on land, if you call the cost of building something on land a dollar, if you build something near shore at a port facility, it might be $2. But if you go offshore and try to build something, it might be $6 to $10 for that same unit. So you want to work as much as you can onshore or near shore, and then do very little, if almost as little as possible when you go farther up. And that's the philosophy we've adopted in Maine in offshore wind, which is very different from the philosophies that have been adopted in Europe. These are some thoughts from what Europe's doing today. Europe is essentially installing offshore wind farms, typically in water depths of 100 feet or less. And they're using a technology called monopiles, shallow monopiles. These are drilled or driven monopiles into the seabed. These could be anywhere from 15 to 18 foot diameter steel piles, 2 to 3 inch thick walls driven into the seabed using these big red impact hammers that you see, just like you drive a normal pile, it's just a bigger version of it. And in order for you to do that, you need these jack-up barges, so you have a stable platform. There's only a few of those around the world. They'll cost you $150,000 to $250,000 a day to run these jack-up barges. So to the extent that you can avoid using these jack-up barges, you've got a really real opportunity. The other thing that happens with these jack-up barges, if the weather gets bad out there on you, well, you've got to come back home, and that's a lot of cost. And if you're putting these pilings into the seabed, as has happened in Europe right now, and you run into a soil layer you haven't expected, you can really run into trouble. Off the UK, they were installing a farm this year, where they're driving an 18-foot diameter pile in, and all of a sudden, the pile dropped over 20 feet. Unexpectedly, as they were driving it, because they hit a soil layer they weren't aware of. So what do you do now? You've got this $150,000 to $250,000 a day jack-up barge, and now you don't know what to do. Okay, so there's a lot of uncertainty, if you wish, which increases the cost of capital. So this is not just about the cost of capital, but also the capital cost. So you've got to look at both of the things. What does it cost you to borrow money? And the more uncertain the construction out there is, the more it costs you to borrow the money, and the more the project will cost a developer. So how big are these things being built in Europe today? A lot bigger than what we're building on land right now. Europe is looking at 5 megawatt turbines. What we have up in Mars Hill is 1.5 megawatt turbines right now. These turbines are typically anywhere from 250 to 300 feet to the hub from the water level. And these blades, as I said, is 170 to 200 feet long on the 5 megawatt turbines. There's also designs, Clipper, for example, has a design now that they're developing for a 10 megawatt turbine to be used off the UK. So we can make things quite a bit bigger offshore, because you can assemble these things near the water and take them out there. You don't need to build roads to top some mountains. So you can make them quite a bit bigger, which makes them a lot more efficient. Now, what if you don't have the right soil conditions to drive a pile in? What is Europe doing? Well, Europe is using these what we call gravity foundations. There's a few, a lot less than the steel piles in Europe are using this technology, but how does it work? These are very big hollow concrete shells. And if you can see here, there's a car or a pickup truck next to this concrete shell. And this is looking inside the shell. This staircase going down the shell. These are very big, big concrete shells that are floated to site using barges, as you see here, and dropped in, filled with rocks. The towers are bolted to them, and then the cranes lift the turbines and the blades. Now, the turbines, the blades lifted up there can weigh 200 to 400 tons. Metric tons worth of material being lifted 300 feet in the air. As you might expect, the kind of cranes you need to do that offshore, sitting on jack-up barges, are not inexpensive. It's not inexpensive equipment. What if the water depth is between 100 and 200 feet? What do you do? In that space, Europe really hasn't gone there very much. There's only 3 projects in Europe in that depth space. And the most common design used for that is called a tripod, like that, because you can't use a single pile. A single pile isn't stable enough to do that. And you have to take, and I've seen these tripods here in Bremerhaven in northern Germany. That's what they're putting these in right now. I've seen dozens of these being manufactured in Germany and being taken over 40 kilometers offshore to be sunk into the seabed and the towers bolted to them. Inexpensive? What do you think? No, very expensive type of designs. So to summarize where Europe is, that's where the competition is. These are offshore farms currently operating in Europe in different colors. Every color represents a different kind of foundation system. What you see in red, the most common type of foundation system, is the monopiles, the steel monopiles we talked about, driven or drilled into the seabed. The second most common type of foundation, if you can't drive them into the seabed, is shown in white, and that's the gravity footings. These are the concrete shells filled with rocks on site. And finally, what you see here in yellow, there's only 3 dots in yellow out there. These are the transitional water depth between 100 and 200 feet. And these are very heavy and very expensive foundation systems. We don't recommend them right now. So what happens when you go over 200 feet of depth? There are no operating wind farm in the world in the water depth of over 200 feet. And because it gets too expensive for foundation systems. Now, who is the leading country in the world currently, today, in offshore wind technology development? That's the UK. In terms of, they have the most aggressive plan to build offshore wind. They're building offshore wind as we speak at about 1,000 megawatt a year in the UK, and that's going to accelerate over the next few years. So they're putting quite a bit in there right now. Back in January in the UK, they announced the winner of the round three bids for offshore farms off the coast of the UK. What you see in green are the different areas off the UK that have been pre-approved for offshore wind development. And then they've bid out these areas, and they've provided tenders to a number of companies, and those were done in January. The goal for the UK is to produce one quarter of all of its electricity from offshore wind by 2020. According to estimates, they will attract $120 million of investment into the UK, and that money is rolling in as we speak, and will create 60,000 jobs. Okay. Now, why is Europe, why is the UK moving in that direction? Because there are two words that they don't like to repeat a lot in Europe. One is called Russia, and the other one is called natural gas. And they're very concerned about the supply chain and energy independence, essentially, for natural gas and what the Russians will or will not do with that supply. So they're moving aggressively in that direction. The other reason they're moving aggressively in that direction, they have some essentially CO2 requirements, emission requirements they want to meet by 2020. The second most aggressive country in Europe right now in offshore wind is Germany. And then Germany gets closer to Russia, okay, as it might expect. They're very concerned about the natural gas supplies. They're moving in earnest. Right now, today in Europe, 50% of all construction activity for offshore wind farms is in the UK. 25% is in Germany. So what do the costs look like? Well, they haven't looked very good recently in Europe. The costs have gone up significantly recently, but we understand why. And we think we have a better way to skin the cat. This is the average cost of two offshore farms, one of the first two built in Europe. And it's divided up into different categories. If you see about half the cost of farm, 50%, are the turbines, the blades, and then getting them out there on top of the towers. About 21% is the cost of foundations. So between the turbines and the foundations, that's almost three quarters of the cost of these units. So therefore, if we're going to cut the cost down, we've got to figure out how to build better turbines, get them up easier on top of the tower, and then reduce the cost of foundations. This is the cost of offshore wind, the capex cost of offshore wind starting in 1990 in Europe through 2010 and beyond. What you see here in circles are actual farms, either constructed or being bid or being completed or being bid or under construction in Europe. And the larger the circle, the bigger the farm. And as you see here, the costs on the left-hand side are in US dollars per megawatt hour, per megawatt of installation. So this is in, so you started out about $1.50 a watt back in 1995, and this is in constant dollars in 1995. And those numbers back in 2006 took a right turn and went up right up through the roof in Europe. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the major reasons is the supply chain isn't well developed in Europe. The demand went up for offshore wind in Europe so fast, and the supply chain, the turbine manufacturing, didn't catch up with the demand. And also, there's been a consolidation in the industry. For example, some companies have bought the competitors on the turbine side. And one of the companies who had the back before that had the workhorse of the offshore farm, which is the Vestas V90 turbine, had some mechanical problems. We pulled out of the market back at that time, so they left a large hole in the marketplace. Plus, the cost of the infrastructure to get these farms up there, the jack-up barges we talked about, the cranes. There's not too many of them out there, and the demand went up. So all of a sudden, if you look at that 90-degree turn, it's not a normal business cycle. Things like that don't happen. So in Europe, the expectation is that if the supply chain catches up, then these prices will go down. Now, let's turn to what we're doing here. The Deep Sea Wind Consortium that we've assembled has over 35 companies and spans the United States. Most of the companies are in Maine. The goal here is to develop floating wind turbines. These are turbines that can be placed 20 to 50 miles offshore, that could be beyond the horizon, and that would potentially reduce the cost of offshore wind. And why, I'll tell you in just a minute. But the next question is, how do we float a wind turbine? How do we have a wind turbine that can withstand the northeast, some of the storms we have off the coast of Maine and beyond? How many of you have seen the movie here that where we all know we've seen 150 miles per hour winds. Okay. All right. So it is possible to get 150 miles per hour winds here off the coast of Maine. The Perfect Storm, if that's the movie or the book. So the question is, how do you design for the perfect storm? And that's a challenge that we're all working on in great detail within our team. And you'll hear more about that this afternoon. Now, but how do I float a wind turbine? The most common type of floating, large floating structures out there come from the oil and gas industry. And as part of our consortium, we have some of the best in the oil and gas industry working with us, Technique being one of them. Now, in the oil and gas world, there's three different types of floating oil and gas turbines. And they're called spar designs, tension-like platforms, or buoyancy-based designs. And the question is, can we adapt these designs to floating wind turbines? Can we get the cost down so we can build cost-effective floating wind turbines? The most simplest design of all these is called the buoyancy-based ballast-stabilized design. Think of it as a large tube, vertical tube, with a ballast near the bottom. If you went to Home Depot, got a 2x4 8-footer, and attached a piece of steel to one end and tossed it into the water, what happens? Okay? Where the steel is, at the end of the 2x4, it's going to come down and sink, and the 2x4 would stick vertically up in the water. Now, if you push on top of that 2x4 floating in the water and let go, what happens to it? It comes back up. Okay? So that's what the spar design is. It's that simple. But instead of being a 2x4, 8 feet long, think about now a 500-foot long unit instead of 8 feet long, 27 feet in diameter under the water instead of being 2-inch by 4-inch diameter under the water, and then 20 feet in diameter above the water. These units we're talking about are bigger than the Washington Monument. Okay? And that's why they're stable. If I was going to build a little lobster boat to put it out there in a perfect storm, it's not going to survive. But if I build something like that, I've got a chance to make it survive. And that's really what we're looking to do. Now, this is one design. There's the tension-leg platform is another design. Essentially, it's got a buoyancy unit right here, and then tension cables embedded into the seabed. And the tension in the cable keeps it from essentially tipping over. And the third design is a buoyancy-based design. Some of these are called semi-submersibles, and there's a variety of companies that have buoyancy-based designs. One is Principal Power, that's part of a consortium, and we'll be hearing from them this afternoon. This unit has three buoyancy-based units and a tower on one corner. There's a company called WindSea out of Norway that has a similar design, but put a tower on each corner. Okay? There's a whole bunch of designs out there, different designs. The mooring line stabilized, the tension-like platforms, a company called Blue H, who's built a demo unit off the coast of Italy. In terms of the spar designs, Statoil out of Norway has the only operating floating wind turbine in the world today. It's off the coast of Norway. And there's another design called Sway, which is a downwind design. Let's go back and see, how big are these things? Okay, are they really, are we trying to build oil and gas rigs? We're not trying to build oil and gas rigs. We're trying to learn from the oil and gas industry to figure out how to build cost-effective and durable structures. And that's why we're partnering with them. One of our major partners in our consortium is Technip. Technip has 22,000 employees around the world, 2,000 employees in Texas. And they built all but two of the floating oil and gas spar rigs in the world. So they know what they're doing. They've been out there for 40 years doing this stuff. So they're one of our partners, and we're working with them to see how to adapt these designs to floating wind turbines. These are different spar designs built by Technip over the years. And right next to these designs, I put in yellow a floating wind turbine using the spar design that's steadily built off the coast of Norway. This unit here is 500 feet long, bigger than the Washington Monument, floating next to an oil and gas rig. So we're not trying to build oil and gas rigs. Now, this oil and gas rigs might cost you $1 billion to $4 billion, depending on how big it is. This unit in yellow needs to be $15 million or less. So we're not trying to build the oil and gas rigs. Right? Now, how about costs? The cost of shallow water foundations versus the cost of deep water foundations. Now, if you're in this business, and these are a lot of people in this business in Europe, here's what everybody thinks. The deeper the water is, the more costly it's going to be. So stay away from deep waters is what everybody tells you in Europe today. What we found over the last year of our work at the university is that folks, maybe not. Let's not quickly go out and say that, particularly if you float the turbines. What I'm going to show you here is we had a competition that the university put together, the Deep Sea Wind Consortium put together, that asked different designers from across the world and the US to provide ideas for floating wind turbines. And we received 12 different designs. And there was a blue ribbon panel that took all these designs and ranked them. And today, we went from 12 designs to 5 designs. We have 5 left on the table. And these 5 designers, design teams, are going through a competition, and by the end of this year, we're going to have 3 of those designs selected. Okay. Now, the goal here is dollars per kilowatt hour. How do I get the costs down in dollars per kilowatt hour? So we start with a blank sheet of paper and said, how do I get those costs down? And I'm going to share with you some data we've learned here over the years to get us to rethink whether deeper means more expensive. What we have here on this map, on this chart, on the vertical axis is the weight in metric tons of the foundation system of a wind turbine. When we say a foundation system, we're talking the weight from the water down. Okay? And we're going to compare the weight of shallow offshore wind, like they want to do of the Massachusetts coast. That's the Cape Wind project, the shallow offshore wind project, where they're going to drive piles into the seabed. We're going to compare the weight of these kinds of structures to the weight of floating designs, and to see, does it make sense actually to do floating design? If it weighs way too much more, then we're probably backing up the wrong tree. So here's some actual data, and what you see here in this chart are the monopiles, and the next is a floating spar design, the next is a tension leg platform design, and the next is a semi-submersible design. And for each design, in this case we have 3 designs. Here we have 3 designs, 1 design in this case, and 3 designs in this case. And we're comparing the weight of these designs under the water. Now let's start with the monopiles. As I said, the monopiles, you don't want to take them in more than 100 feet of water because it gets to be too costly. What I'm showing on this chart, and I'm going to cover only one of these monopiles, the one in blue right here. The blue monopile is in water depths of about 30 meters, about 100 feet. So the blue chart is 100 foot deep water. In that 30 meter depth, you need a bigger pile, of course, from the water down, the water level down. How big of a pile do you need in this case? You need about a 70 meter pile, 210 foot long pile under the water. Now, that pile first reaches the bottom of the seabed, it's 100 feet, it gets to go into the seabed another distance. It'll go into the seabed another 40 meters, about 120 feet. So this pile has a total length of 70 meters. From the water level under. Okay. And how thick are the walls in that pile, and how big is this pile? This pile is 7.5 meters in diameter, so it's about 22 feet in diameter. That's a big pile. That's a 22-foot diameter pile. So the thickness of the wall in that pile is 7 centimeters. So this is, we're talking over 2.5 inches, 3 inches of thickness on the walls of this pile. Okay, so this is a very deep, this is a very heavy pile. How much does that pile weigh? It weighs about 830 metric tons. Okay, from the water level down to the under the sea, that's how much steel you have to hold up this single monopile, which is what Europe's doing today. Let us compare that to the floating turbine. Again, we're going to compare the floating turbine again from the water level down to see how much does it weigh. And we have 3 different designs that we've looked at for floating wind turbines, for spar designs. And I'm going to give you one in very deep waters, 120 meters of water. If you have a draft of 120 meters, 360 feet. Okay. Now you would think, geez, if it's got to float, it's got to be quite a bit heavier, so you can have the buoyancy needed. Maybe not. Let's take a look at the weight. That unit, 120 in 120 foot draft, would have a 9 meter hull. So the hull is 27 feet. What was the hull on the other unit? 7.5 meters. So this is a bigger hull. You'd expect a floating unit to have a bigger hull. So it does. Okay. But the wall thickness. How thick is the wall in that floating unit? Only 3.5 centimeters, so half the thickness of the wall needed on a driven pile. So yes, it's a bigger unit, but the wall thickness is so much less. So the weight is not much different. Actually, the weight is about 1,000 metric tons. So we went from 820 or 30 metric tons to 1,000 metric tons. But what have we done? What have we done? Okay. Now all of a sudden, I don't need a jack-up barge anymore to do this, right? I don't need to go out and work in the middle of the ocean to assemble this thing. I can assemble this thing potentially in dry dock, and most of it in a dry dock, so cutting a lot of those costs. I can work year-round in a dry dock assembling things and then take them out there, okay, whether it's in Chimbrow's facility in Brewer or DIW's facility or where else. And all of a sudden, I've reduced significantly my logistics of manufacturing and risks to the chlorine units. Now, if you go to tension leg platforms, we've received only one entry in our competition for tension leg platforms, And that weight actually was not much different than the weight of that monopile I told you about, the weight of the tension leg platform under the water. However, if you look at the tension leg platform, it's a more complicated design as a tube. Okay, if you think of just a single tube here versus this unit that has multiple components and welds and so forth, a tube is the easiest thing to do. Okay. And also compare the tube in this case. This is a floating spar versus this tube right here which is a driven monopile. That tube is half the wall thickness. So which one's easier to make? The one that's half the wall thickness, a lot easier to bend. So from a manufacturing viewpoint, it would be quite a bit easier to make this one than to make that one in terms of what you have to bend for steel. Now, if you go to the semi-submersibles, we've received a number of designs and they vary quite a bit in weight. So it looks like the semi-submersibles industries needs to look at their designs with a more fine-tooth comb. But the weights have ranged in the 830 metric tons up to about 1,800 metric tons. So they vary quite a bit in weight here in the semi-submersible. So what we've learned from all this is the following. The weight of a floating wind turbine is not necessarily much bigger than the weight of a monopile under the water. Okay? And that's a very, very important piece to that. Because if it doesn't weigh as much more, then at least the dollars per pound doesn't have to be much different. If I can make the unit, it's a lot easier to manufacture that unit and get it out there, then I can actually save money on the unit. So the normal thought process, if I go into deeper water, it means I'm going to be more expensive. We actually were challenging today. We're challenging and putting a question mark on that thought process. I'm going to show you another design. Okay, again, comparing the weights of 5 megawatt turbines, fixed turbines, versus floating turbines. And in this case, we're going to go and compare. I'm going to compare, because of time, the jacket structures with the spar design. Now, a jacket structure is used in deeper water in Europe. Actually, this particular project is a real project, so I have real numbers and weights for you. This jacket structure is off the coast of Germany. It's called the Alpha Ventus Project. Some of you actually went up and saw the Alpha Ventus Project in northern Germany, about 40 kilometers north of the island of Juist in Germany. Now, what did they do there? They had relatively deep water there. They have about 100 feet worth of water at that location. So they didn't use a monopile. They used a jacket structure. The jacket structure is a lattice structure with a driven piles to keep it stable at the bottom. Now, this whole lattice was manufactured, was put on a barge, brought over there, sunk into the seabed, and then after they sunk this thing into the seabed, they drove pilings all around it. 8 piles, about 1.1 meters in diameter, were driven all around the base of that jacket. Now, if any of you is in construction, and Peter can tell you, that's not an inexpensive operation. You got to make this thing. It's a lot more complicated than a tube. You got to get it on a barge. You got to take it out there. You got to sink it into the seabed. Then you got to drive piles all around it. Now, how much does this unit weigh? That unit weighs about 815 metric tons. That's what you see in yellow. It weighs 815 metric tons, and it's broken into two parts. The jacket portion weighs 500 metric tons. And the 8 piles driven at the bottom of the jacket weigh collectively another 315 metric tons. You add them up, you get 815 metric tons of steel that has been taken out there, assembled, and driven into the seabed. Contrast that to the floating spar we talked about earlier on a previous slide. That spar is 1,000 metric tons. Okay? So we're comparing now a 1,000 metric ton tube, which can be manufactured on shore, versus an 815 metric ton rig, which is requires a lot of welds, requires driving 8 piles into the seabed. Which one do you think would be more expensive? So question, does it really make sense to say all of a sudden deeper floating is more expensive? The answer is not necessarily. So the other piece I want to tell you about is, it's not only the weight of the structure. We've established today, I think, we can all agree today, that the weight of a floating wind turbine under the water is not necessarily more than the weight of a monopile driven into the seabed. Actually, I'd like to think of a spar as a monopile that somebody drives into the seabed. Okay, that's how we talked about it up in our lab right now. Okay? So the other thing that's really important is this data that we've collected and developed recently. And is the wind gets to be a heck of a lot better the farther out you go. Okay, so there's a good reason to go out there, not just because you don't see them anymore, but because the wind gets to be much better. How much better? Here's a study we just finished. And this is based on 9 years of data we've collected. The University of Maine has had, as you know, through the through the college, through the School of Marine Sciences, and Pete Jumars, the head of the school, is up here, has deployed the GOMO buoy system, designed, built, and deployed the Gulf of Maine Ocean Observing System. These are buoys floating across the Gulf of Maine. They've been collecting wind speed data as well as wave data for almost 90 years right now. And what we've done is we've selected, in green here, five of those buoys. We've been busy collecting data. And then in yellow, buoys that are farther out. These are the two ones we have way out there. And then we selected in red the Mars Hill farm. Okay? And then what we did is compare the output per year of these farms based on a 5 megawatt, assuming that it was all 5 megawatt units. What would be the output of a 5 megawatt unit at Mars Hill, on top of a hill? What would be the output in the green locations of a 5 megawatt turbine? And these green locations vary in distance from shore from 6 miles to 13 nautical miles. So all the green ones are between 6 and 13 nautical miles. Nowhere would we want to go. Remember, we want to go 20 miles and more. That's where we want to go. Now, the yellow buoys are 42 and 56 miles out. What we did is took a turbine called the NREL 5 megawatt turbine. It has a very well-known power curve. We took that turbine and placed it at those locations using the wind data we've collected over 9 years and asked ourselves, how much energy every year does that turbine generate? And here's the results. If you call the Mars Hill farm, on a 5 megawatt basis, 1.0 is the generation of the Mars Hill farm. If you compare that to the green locations, which are the near shore offshore, between 6 and 13 miles offshore, you can see the green locations have more wind on the average. Not all of them, though. If you look at location C here, that location actually is not much better than Mars Hill. And that location C is about 7 nautical miles offshore, right here off the coast of Maine. That's just about as good as Mars Hill. However, the remaining ones, green ones, are more than Mars Hill. Location B, for example, has about 10% more output per year than Mars Hill. That's good. But here's the revelation. If you're at location G and H, 40 and 50 miles offshore, then you have 33% more energy you can produce every year than a mountaintop wind farm. Now that's important. Now all of a sudden, I can generate 33% more income out of my farm if it's out there than if it is on top of Mars Hill. Okay? And I can make much bigger turbines, I can make them year-round, and I don't need to drive to build roads to tops and mountains. Okay? That's what we're talking about. So is it possible, because the combination of the weight we talked about and the better resource we have farther offshore, to actually reduce the cost of offshore wind versus shallow offshore wind that Europe has done? We think absolutely yes. Okay. We've got to prove it to ourselves. Our data shows that we possibly can. That's the revelation. But we've got homework to prove it to ourselves and to the rest of the world. So what kind of homework are we doing? Well, one of the major keys of the homework is figuring out how to predict what happens to a floating wind turbine when the perfect storm arrives. Okay. What happens when you have 150 mile per hour winds and you have 60 foot waves? Which will happen on a 100-year event out there in the Gulf of Maine. How do you make sure that this unit's going to survive? So one thing we're doing is developing a model coupled aerodynamic hydrodynamic models that predict what happens to these turbines under winds and wave conditions, and you'll hear more about that this afternoon. These models are critical to designing optimized turbines. The other thing we're doing is we're going into the water in June 2012 in July 2012, with a third-scale unit we're going to place off the coast of Maine. Now, that third-scale unit will be the best of the 12 designs we've had a competition with, okay? Now, as you know, there's a lot of designs out there, and every company would like to tell you, and for good reason, that their design is the best design. But the question is, what is really the best design for a floating wind turbine? And that's what we're trying to do under this DOE funding. We're independent, we're trying to look at all these designs using a variety of experts and trying to figure out what is the best design out there. And now, the best design, of course, will bring the dollars per kilowatt hour as far down as possible. We don't know what design we're going to deploy yet, but we'll know here at the end of the month, at the end of the year, what design we'll be deploying. Now, off the coast of Monhegan Island, so you know, there will be no developments. We are not doing out there a commercial development. It's just a test site. It's a laboratory that the university will use to test out different designs. And this is this is Monhegan Island. The location off Monhegan Island where the university can do the testing is 2.5 miles south of Monhegan. And this is where Monhegan Island is, off the coast of Maine. It's about, the island is 10 to 12 miles off the coast of Maine, depending on where you measure from. So this site is essentially way offshore, so it simulates the real deep water offshore environment. That site has 200 to 400 feet of water. So the purpose of that is to help us test designs. There's nothing that's going to be permanent at that test site. Okay? And it's only going to be there for a few months of the year. Other things we're doing at the test site is making sure we understand the impact of these units on the environment. Very important issues. We don't want to go out there and create environmental problems. So we're working very closely here with a variety of scientists across the country and within the state of Maine. And that environmental evaluation effort is being led by Pete Jumarth. Pete, you want to stand up? Pete is the head of the School of Marine Sciences.
And Heather.
Heather, you want to stand up? Yeah. Thank you, Heather. And what we're doing out there is trying to understand the impact of deploying, installing, operating, and then decommissioning floating wind turbines. What will happen to the environment around us? We're studying what lives above the water. We're studying what lives under the water. Okay. Do we know all the answers? No, we don't. Okay. But we have a very well-designed experiment to try to understand what happens. And we're doing it at a small scale, with a third-scale unit, a 100-foot unit above the water. How long will that unit be at the test site? Not very long. It's going to be out there only for a few months, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. We start collecting data. Pete and his team are collecting data off the coast of Maine using radar deployed on Monhegan Island, scanning the skies over the test site. And there are scientists with GMRI and others that are going back and forth and looking at all the birds and bats and other species that are flying out there. The goal is to identify what lives above the water, but also what lives under the water. We're also evaluating what's under the water. Then the next question is, once we do all that, we're going to do that before we deploy the unit in the water, then we're going to measure what happens as we deploy the unit. Is there any changes in the environment above the water and below the water? Are the fish affected? Are the birds affected? Are the fish coming back or not going to come back to the area? These are some of the things we're concerned about. And then when the unit starts to operate, what are the environmental impacts? Okay? Are the fish coming back? Are the fish leaving? Do they like it and come and start creating colonies around it? Or the vibrations are causing problems? We don't know the answers to a floating wind turbine. Europe, though, have done this since 1991. They've placed wind turbines in the water since 1991. They understand, at least in their environment, what the impact is. And it has been very positive. They haven't seen issues. But it doesn't mean that we won't see issues, and we're trying to make sure we study this very well before we start building anything. And that's, so you got to test it, otherwise we'd never know what the answer is. Now, how long will this unit be in the water? The third scale unit. Remember how big the bigger units are? The 5 megawatt turbines are about 300 feet to the hub. A third scale unit would be 100 feet to the hub. So the question to you is, what kind of environment would the third scale unit see out there? Okay, are we? Is there a chance to destroy the unit quickly over the winter? As you know, the wind gets to be a heck of a lot worse in the winter time off the Gulf of Maine. Now, here's some data. Of the wind speeds as well as wave heights off Monhegan Island, about 0.8 of a mile off the test site in Monhegan Island. We have a buoy that's been out there for almost 9 years, and we've analyzed the data from that buoy. What that shows us is that on a full scale, the 50-year return period wind is about 35.6 meters per second. Okay, so multiply that by over two, a little over two, and you get miles per hour. The significant wave height is about 10 meters, about 30 feet. What's a significant wave height? It's the average of the third highest waves. That's what a significant wave height. The maximum wave height is bigger than that. It's 1.86 times the significant wave height. So the maximum wave height at that site, 50-year wave height, is about 18.6 meters. Okay, that's about almost 60 feet. 50 to 60 foot is the maximum wave height at that site. So folks, if we don't design for a 50 to 60 foot wave, we've got a problem. Okay. But now the next question becomes, what is a 50-year return period wave height, maximum wave height, on a third-scale unit? Okay. Well, if it's 60 feet for a full unit, on a third-scale unit, a 20-foot wave height is a 50-year event for a third-scale unit, right? Okay, so what happens then? Okay, here's some data we've collected to look at the probability of seeing a 50-year wave height, maximum wave height, okay, or significant wave height, in different months of the year in any 1 week. So, translated into another sentence here, what's the probability of exceeding a 10-foot significant wave height in any week of the year, in any month of the year. That's what this chart shows. I'm going to look at the numbers here. So if we deploy a third scale unit, which is 100 feet to the hub, in July in the water, we have a probability of 0% of seeing a 10-foot wave in July in any one week. Okay? If we move from July to August, we have a 1% probability of seeing a 10-foot wave height at that site. If we go to September, we have a 4% probability of seeing a 10-foot wave height. Remember, a 10-foot wave height is a 50-year event for a third-scale unit. October, November, we get a 50-50 probability of seeing a 10-foot wave height in any week, either in October or November. What does that mean? We better be ready to get out of there as quickly as possible, because that's a 50-year event on a third-scale unit. So we plan to pull this unit we put in the water. We're going to put that unit in the water in July. We're going to pull it out in October or November once we see a 50-year event, which is all we need. If we see a 50-year event, we're happy. We collect our data. We come home. We'll bring it back. So this unit will be in the water only between July and November at most. Okay. So the environmental impact of putting something for that short of a period of time in the water, of course, is important, but it shouldn't be very high. This unit is about 100 feet above the water, and we're doing everything we can to understand what impact deploying that unit for a few months in the water would be. To put that in perspective, that unit is not much bigger than the mast on a sailboat that's going out there. And the noise that comes out of the turbines, one thing we're concerned about is as the turbine moves around, it's going to vibrate, and the vibrations will be transmitted into the water. What is the effect of the vibrations on the fish? What is the effect on mammal life? These are very important issues, and that's what Pete Jumar is trying to help us identify. You've heard about that, hear about that more this afternoon. But frankly, on the unit this big, I'm not sure the noise it's going to make is much bigger than the rudder, than the propeller on the boat. Okay. So anyway, so we go out there, we put this unit in the water in June 2012. We shake the bugs out of it. What do we do next? The next step, once we've learned all of that, collected the environmental information, if all checks out well, the next step is work on building a bigger unit, a single bigger unit in the 3 to 5 megawatt range that would be deployed sometime in 2013, 2014. And then following that, expand that to a 25 megawatt farm. It's a walk before you run approach. A 25 megawatt farm might have 5 megawatt units in it. So we're going from a third scale unit to a single 5 megawatt unit to 5 megawatt units. That's what we walk before you run. As we do all that, we study not only how these units work, but what impact they have on the environment around them. Unless we do the studies, we'd never know. That's why we're doing the studies. Now, one thing that's exciting is, and I'd like to give the legislature in the state of Maine and the governor, recognize them for what they've done. They put together a bill that allows us to actually go to bids, and the Maine PUC had put together on September 1st a bid for the first floating wind farm in the world. And that went out to bids on September 1st for up to a 25 megawatt floating farm. And that needs to be built within 5 years of signing a contract with the winning developer. So September 1st, let's talk about the RFP for the 25 megawatt farm. What's the process? So September 1st, the request for proposals was issued by the Maine Public Utilities Commission. When are the proposals due? Any developer can bid on that. The responses are due in May. So the PUC would like to see responses coming back from developers in May. Then what's the carrot for the developers? The carrot is, by statute in the state of Maine, the utilities in Maine would buy the output of this farm over a 20-year period. Okay, that's the carrot for the developer. At prices above market, slightly above market when averaged over the population of the state. So essentially, you don't have to buy the output of that farm because we know it's going to be more expensive. It's a very small farm. That first farm, and I'm going to tell everybody today, not expect any miracles. That first farm will be expensive. It's a small project. It's the first one of its kind. It's going to be a learning experience for any developer and everybody involved. So it will be very expensive. And because it's expensive, we wanted to go ahead and buy this output at a higher cost than the marketplace. But we didn't want to burden the population of the state. So what we did is spread the output of that 25 megawatt farm on the entire population. If you do that, the impact is very minimal. It's less than a cents per kilowatt hour a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour impact on your bill. So most of us won't even notice the change here on the bill. So that's what would attract a developer to the state to do this. So what did the state get out of it? Okay. Well, the developer, once they sign a contract with the state, has 5 years to build that farm. So if the developer is selected in 2011, the contract is signed by the end of 2011, this farm should be built before the end of 2016. That's the 25 megawatt farm. Now, this is an opportunity for a lot of us to really participate at the ground level to build the first floating farm in the world. That farm will cost roughly, building that farm, permitting the farm, laying the cables, everything in place, might be a $150 million project. So there's a $150 million opportunity, construction opportunity for all of us here in the state of Maine coming down the horizon from a business viewpoint. Now, what does the developer have to do? Now, we're told the carrot for the developer will buy the output for 20 years. What does the developer have to do? By statute, and by, if you look at the RFP from the PUC, the developer should grow this farm to at least 100 megawatts. We'd like to see it much bigger than 100. Actually, a lot of developers are looking at 500 megawatts plus. Okay. We'd like to see it grow to between 500 to 1,000 megawatts by 2020. Okay. What does the developer have to do? In order to win the bid, there are certain criteria by statute built into the RFP. One of them is looking at economic development in the state of Maine. How much local people the developer will use, what plans they have to potentially place turbine manufacturing facilities, blade manufacturing facilities in the state, how they will work with construction companies and others and engineers within the state of Maine. So the more they're going to use local content, the more points they will get. Okay, that's one of the criteria that we're looking to do. So local content is key. The other piece that's really important, I'd like to give here the state really the entire administration, the Baldacci administration and the commissioners there, really the credit for working very hard to cut down the five-year typical to 10-year permitting cycle for this farm to less than 3 years. Okay. And the states put together a task force with Bumry. Bumry is the MMS follow-on. And when MMS broke up because of the Gulf disaster, Bumry was created. Bumry will provide leases for offshore wind farms in federal waters. So if you're over 3 nautical miles off the coast of Maine, you have to permit your farm under Bumry requirements. And currently, it's going to take 5 to 10 years to permit if you follow Bumry requirements as they are today. So that would be a long time to wait before you start constructing this farm. What we've done is we've put together an experimental process using adaptive management that the states put together to at least permit this farm in 3 years. However, do a lot more monitoring to see what happens. Okay. Now, who can build this in Maine? Do we have the capacity to build in Maine? I'm going to lead into here Peter Vigneau's presentation. Chimbaro, as you know, has built quite a bit bigger structures than that. General Dynamics, that Ironworks has. Technique is another one of our partners here for fabrication and deployment. But Chimbaro has constructed much bigger structures than what we're talking about here today. These are semi-submersibles that were manufactured in Portland, Maine by Chimbaro. You can barely see cars on this dock. That's how big this unit is. And they were made in Maine. These are fifth generation semi-submersibles, GPS located, so they're untethered. They drill in what? How much depth of water? 10,000 feet of water. Made here in Maine and towed from Portland, Maine, all the way down to Brazil for offshore or exploration. A lot bigger than anything we've built. Okay, using this using floating wind turbines. Can we do this in Maine? The answer is absolutely yes. We can. We could do this. General Dynamics, Bath Ironworks, has also a wonderful dry dock where we could potentially assemble these units. Now think about now making these units in a dry dock. The foundation is manufactured there. You have cranes on the dry dock. You put your towers on. You put your turbine on there. You put the blades on. And if you use a semi-submersible design, you can pull the whole thing out. All you need is a 20-ton tugboat. It's about a six-hour trip, 20 miles offshore. And then you drop anchor. Now think about doing that versus driving 18 or 20-foot diameter piles into the seabed using jack-up barges. What's less expensive? Okay, that's what we're backing up. That's why we're excited about this opportunity, because we believe we can cut the cost down versus shallow offshore wind technology. Technique is another member of our consortium, and they built actually the floating wind turbine that Statoil built off the coast of Norway. That unit, which is 500 feet long total, was built by Technip. It was actually manufactured in Finland. And this is a foundation for that unit. That's 300 feet long, actually 313 feet long, 27 feet in diameter, piece of steel, okay, tube, steel tube, and that was made in a shop no different than the Chimbrose or Beth Einhorn shops, and they were towed horizontally from Norway, from Finland to Norway, and then it was righted up by adding water on one end to it, okay, in a protected bay off the coast of Norway, and then the tower was placed on top using a crane and a turbine, and then it was towed from the protected bay out 10 miles offshore, vertically up with the turbine on top, with the blades on top, and I've seen a video where it's already seen 40-foot waves. I have a video of it in 40-foot waves, so it works very well. Now, so where do we go with all this? The governor's Ocean Energy Task Force recommended 5 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030. 5 gigawatts is essentially 3% of the offshore wind resource off the Gulf of Maine. So there is some misconception that we're going to go out and put 149 gigawatts of wind off the coast of Maine. No, we're not going to do that. Nobody wants to do that. What we're trying to do here is only use 3% of that resource off the Gulf of Maine. That's all. And we believe, at least as a committee, we all believe in that this was a very reasonable goal, that we could find areas off the coast of Maine where the environmental impact is minimal. Now, does that mean we're not going to have an environmental impact? Absolutely not. No matter what we do as human beings on Earth, we're going to have an environmental impact. The trick here is how do you minimize your environmental impact as you compare it to other activities that you do. And that's what we're trying to do. We want to do this right and make sure we do it in steps, so the walk before you run approach. Everything we're going to put in will be 20 plus miles offshore. And because of the curvature of the Earth, we're not going to see these units at all from that, and we're not going to hear it from them either. Now, can the state of Maine use 5 gigawatts of wind? The answer is no, not today. We can't use today 5 gigawatts of wind. To do that, we need an improved transmission infrastructure. We need to use wind in a different way. Okay, now we're going to run the whole state on wind? No, we can't. Nobody wants to run the whole state on wind. What we want to do is reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. How do we do that? There's two critical ways to do that. People say we can't store wind. The answer is yes, you can store wind. Okay, and you don't have to store it all in one place. So one of the most common ways that analysts across the country and the world are looking at is use plug-in hybrid vehicles. How many of you have been reading about the GM Chevy Volt? Okay, the Chevy Volt right now is coming up this year, and GM is banking a lot of its future on the success of the Chevy Volt. It's essentially this enhanced range electric vehicle. On a full charge, it has a 300-pound battery in it. On a full charge, it'll travel 40 miles. But it has a gas tank on it that will recharge your battery when you run out of juice on the battery, and that will let you go another 300 miles. So this whole thing goes about 340 miles on a full charge. The advantage of that is that most of us use our cars, 80% of us use our cars for less than 40 miles a day. So 80% of us would not need to put gasoline in our cars every day. We could be using the wind off the coast of Maine to fill our cars, okay, rather than import oil from out of the state of Maine. And that's how we directly substitute oil for wind. And that's how we do it. Let us imagine a world here where gasoline goes up to $4 or $5 a gallon. Is that impossible to imagine? Okay. At $4 or $5 a gallon, and by using time of the day pricing of electricity, where we can buy cheap electricity at night, if we implement that across the state of Maine, we might be able to buy electricity at 8 or 9 cents a kilowatt hour after midnight. And if we did that, then you can compare that to $4 or $5 of gasoline. All of a sudden, it makes a lot of economic sense to go in that direction. Other states are moving in that direction as well. California has an incentive for these vehicles, I know, so we can get them out there. $5,000 tax incentive. The federal government has $7,500 tax incentive for these vehicles. If we start using these vehicles over the next 20 years, say 20 or 30% of our fleet in the state of Maine, we have 500,000 cars in the state of Maine. If 20 or 30% of those start using these vehicles, all of a sudden, we have a distributed battery that can store all the energy of the wind in those batteries. It doesn't have all to be in one place. Could be a battery all over the state of Maine that does that. And that's what we're looking to do. So yes, we can store the energy. And yes, we can substitute oil for clean electrons coming off the Gulf of Maine. Heating is the other piece. You can store heat. They actually use technologies today for thermal heat storage. These are big bricks you can heat up with resistance heaters. And then they can stay hot 12 to 24 hours. And you can use electricity to blow on the hot bricks and heat up your home. This technology exists today, and there are other technologies for storing heat. So between that and plug-in hybrids, we ought to be able to store this energy. Now, one thing that's really also critical for us in Maine is the average wind speed off the coast of Maine in the wintertime are roughly twice what they are in the summertime. Therefore, you can extract 8 times as much energy per turbine in the winter than you can in the summer. So we can use that energy to heat our homes. That's when we need to heat our homes. So that's the plan. If we did that, and we've laid out a walk before you run approach from a technology viewpoint as well as from an environmental impact viewpoint, we started with a third scale unit in 2012, then a full size unit in 2013-14, a 25 megawatt farm by 2016, and then expand that to 500 to 1,000 megawatts by 2020, and then a whole bunch of other farms by 2030. So walk before you run. The University of Maine is going to help bidders. We've had bidders conferences here in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago. There's a number of developers interested in the project in Maine. We're going to help developers find sites working with the state that make sense. We've put together a 450-layer GIS database of the Gulf of Maine that tells us what's out there to make sure we select sites that have the minimal environmental impact and easy to connect to the grid. You'll hear more about that this afternoon. We'll help developers select floating wind technologies that reduce the cost, and we'll help developers test the units when we put them in the water. This is a shot of the GIS database, the Gulf of Maine that currently exists. The Sewell company now is running it on behalf of the university, and you'll hear about them this afternoon. Other things you might ask yourself, how do I measure the winds at tub heights? When I'm 300 feet or 400 feet of water, how can I build an anemometer tower in 400 feet of water? That's going to cost a lot of money. And what we've received a grant from the Maine Technology Institute to actually deploy potentially the first floating LIDAR system off the coast of the United States. That floating LIDAR system is like a big buoy, like we've already deployed, the Gogo's buoy system, except it's going to have a LIDAR on it, which sends 3 laser beams up in the air, and then can measure the wind speeds at preset elevations, up to 300 feet or so at hub height. And that LIDAR unit will cost less than $1 million versus costing $20 million to put an anemometer tower down into the seabed. And you can move it around, so you can look at multiple sites. That's the beauty of it. It's tethered into the seabed using a cable tether. And that unit has, on top of it, accelerometers, just like you have on your iPhone, that will tell it which way it's oriented. So as it moves around in the waves, it can adjust for that movement in picking up the wind speeds. So some key dates coming forward as I close here. Here's the opportunity we're looking at. If we build 5 gigawatts of wind by 2030, use it to heat homes, use it to fill up cars, and sell the rest of it to the rest of New England by building an undersea transmission line off the coast of Maine, that would be a $20 billion construction project for the state of Maine. Be the largest construction project in the state's history. This would be all private money coming into Maine. So how are we trying to get there? Again, a walk before you run approach. In October, we started bringing developers together. We had a great developers reception at AWEA in New Jersey on October 5th. It was a full house. A lot of developers interested in this. Hopefully we can keep a lot of them continue to be interested in Maine. On October 19th, today, we're doing this conference to inform everybody on what's going on. In November, December, and into next year, we were open to meet with developers and help them prepare good proposals. The state of Maine, I'm sure the PUC would like to see as many good proposals as possible from developers. On February 11th, the University of Maine is going to issue an offshore wind report, which will help all developers prepare good bids. The report will include specific wind information off the coast of Maine. It's going to include geophysical information, grid connectivity information, and so forth, so developers can put proposals in. And we'll have a press event and a day worth of information to be provided for developers. In April of this year, we're going to build 150 scale models and test them in wind wave tanks to figure out what the best designs are. In May 2011, our offshore wind lab will open. In June 2012, Maine will put out the first floating wind turbine off the coast of the United States. And then following that, as we said, will be a 25 megawatt farm. In terms of jobs, the job opportunities are many and they span a large spectrum of opportunities. How many jobs can we create? We could create up to 15,000 jobs a year if we maximize the supply chain. That means we make the turbines in Maine, we make the blades in Maine, we make the towers in Maine. If we don't make the turbines in Maine, then that 15,000 jobs becomes 8,000 jobs. Okay. So it's really critical that we maximize the supply chain to realize the job opportunities that we're talking about. There'll be power collection jobs, power transmission jobs, support structure design and construction. But as you see here, the largest, if you wish, value in the value chain for wind energy is making the turbines. So if we can attract the turbine manufacturer to Maine, we really want it. And Pete and I and others have been working on that very hard, and we'll hear from Pete about that later. So with that in mind, that gets me to the end of the presentation. It was nice to be able to lay out what we'll hear more about for the rest of the day. And what I'd like to do right now is bring Pete up. Pete Vigue, there's nobody who doesn't know who Pete Vigue is, but let me tell you a bit about Pete. It's been a pleasure for me to have worked with Pete and have known Pete for over 10 years right now. Pete truly is the inspiration for all of us in Maine in terms of job creation and job opportunities. He's created hundreds of jobs only in Brewer. He's taken Redding Brewer, essentially a brownfield site, a contaminated site, and turned it into one of the key modular construction facilities in the United States. He's been able to think about, in Maine, being able to kit here in oil refinery, make it in parts here in the state of Maine, and take it all the way to Texas, and compete with anybody in the world cost-wise and quality-wise, and be able to make it in Maine and ship it to Texas cost-effectively. That's the vision that Peter has had, and that vision is a reality today. And more jobs are coming, as you've heard in the papers, for that facility and beyond. Could we use facilities like this to produce the offshore wind components we're talking about? I am convinced we can. I think we can't do that here in Maine. So Peter's proven it over and over again. He has over 2,500 employees. I tell you, Peter has a vision. He has a knowledge. He loves the state of Maine. He works day and night. He calls me up at any time of the day and the night talking about opportunities. He's got them all the time. It is a great pleasure and an honor for me to have worked with Pete. Please help me provide a very warm welcome to the leader of Maine's industry, Pete Vigue.